Okay, our final case this morning for oral argument is 19-2118 United States versus Perez Velasquez, and appellant's counsel may proceed.
Your honors, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Gia McGilvray, and I am here today on behalf of Ms. Perez Velasquez, whom I will refer to as Ms. Perez, and Ms. Alvarado Diaz, whom I will refer to as Ms. Alvarado. Our fundamental submission to the court today is that in Gaspar Miguel, this court acknowledged that the word entry is a term with a well-settled meaning, and that term includes freedom from official restraint. We are asking this court to go one step further and to hold, not to just acknowledge, but to hold that the term entry under 1325A requires freedom from official restraint. Within the context of official restraint, we further ask that on the facts specific and found in Ms. Perez and Ms. Alvarado's cases, that this court find they were both under official restraint and did not enter. In Gaspar Miguel, this court did a very thorough analysis of the history, both legislatively and judicially, of the word entry. That analysis led this court to conclude that the word entry is a term with a well-settled meaning, and that Congress meant to incorporate that well-settled meaning in the Immigration and Nationality Act as modified by the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act.
Isn't it? I don't know that I read that case the same way. It seemed to me that language is there, certainly, as you're saying, but didn't the court just really assume, for the purposes of actually arriving at its conclusion, the court just assumed that it could sort of transfer, I don't know what you would say, import that definition in this context, in the criminal context. It didn't actually, it arguably is dicta.
Well, Your Honor, in that case, this court, after acknowledging what the definition of entry was, or was commonly seen to be, the court then went on to specifically point out that following those amendments, the Bureau of Immigration Appeals and criminal courts, so in the criminal context, that they found that entry is not accomplished unless the alien is free from official restraint.
Well, they assumed it. Yeah, but eventually they said they very specifically assumed that it would require, entry would require, as in the civil context, freedom from official restraint. And then assuming that, they went on to hold, as they did in that case, which the issue that I guess we have it here too, because you've raised it. That's whether constant surveillance, assuming freedom from official restraint, was part of the definition of entry, that the continuous surveillance would fall within that. So I don't see it. They specifically said they were assuming it, is my point. I don't see how you get there with you're assuming that we only have to take the next step, but I'm not sure we've taken the step that you indicate, which is to incorporate
the definition of entry. The court said that they specifically, they said, we acknowledge that the term entry is a term with a well-settled meaning, which incorporates official restraint. So the court's already acknowledged it. I see that there's a distinction between acknowledging it and holding it. But once you've acknowledged that term has a well-settled meaning, very hard at that point to say, but now we are going to say that, as the government would suggest, that entry only requires physical presence.
Well, one thing the court did is recognize the exception to that, which is where the statute would say otherwise. And I think that's what, even if there's a well-settled meaning where the statute indicates otherwise, then the well-settled meaning doesn't apply or doesn't necessarily apply, as the court recognized in Gaspar. And I think that's what we're talking about here is, what does the statute say?
Your Honor, the statute at this point, as noted in the historical review that the court provided, the definition of entry has been excised from the statute. There is no definition of entry in the statute.
Right.
But following that excise of the definition, the courts have continued to hold both the Bureau of Board of Immigration Appeals and criminal courts have continued to hold that entry is that the word entry requires freedom from official restraint. And the court in doing so cited specifically to the Second Circuit, U.S. versus Macias, to the Third Circuit, United States versus Lavelle, and to the Sixth Circuit, Lopez versus Sessions, which is a civil case, but in that civil context, that court said that the Sixth Circuit said that the definition of entry in the criminal context and in the civil context they've noted that the government have been applying them consistently, as they well should.
Well, let me ask you, counsel, where does that get you? If we decide that entry requires freedom from physical restraint, does that help you? What's your physical restraint here? It's surveillance. And that's the reason we didn't have to hold anything with regard to whether official restraint is required or absence of official restraint is required, is that we did hold that surveillance is not sufficient for physical restraint. So how are you distinguished from those cases in that regard?
Your Honor, I understand the court's question, and there is a difference here that I can explain easily to this court. The surveillance that the court was concerned with in Gaspar Miguel is surveillance that was unbeknownst to the would-be entrant. So the entrant in that particular case didn't even know that they were under surveillance. I would like to point out that their surveillance can have various meanings and has had various meanings throughout the cases that have addressed it. Surveillance can be distinguished by whether it's electronically accomplished or by whether it's accomplished by physical actual observation. Electronically, you're relying often on equipment. The surveillance is at a distance. The equipment are things like cameras, binoculars, video surveillance, GPS tracking, satellites, sensors. And in those situations, as I mentioned, typically the alien doesn't even know that he or she is under surveillance. The surveillance isn't practically
so that you're saying. So just to get to your point, I think you're about to get there. What you're saying is, in this case, the defendants did know they were under surveillance, and that distinguishes them from Gaspar, right?
That is, Your Honor, that is correct. I am saying that that is one of the aspects that distinguishes them from Gaspar Miguel.
Well, that's the only way they're distinguishable from Gaspar in terms of freedom from official or physical restraint. Isn't that the only difference?
No, Your Honor.
In what other way were they subject to physical restraint?
Okay, so Your Honor, they were subject to physical restraint in that they were actually at a distance from the Border Patrol agents. They were very close in proximity, so that going back to the traditional sort of definitions of freedom from official restraint, they lacked the freedom to go at large and mix with the population. They were
when they crossed the border.
Yes, Your Honor, when they crossed the border, both of the individuals saw the Border Patrol agents. The Border Patrol agents saw them, and both of the individuals went toward the Border Patrol agents. There was indicia of restraint there in the fact that both of these Border Patrol agents were in trucks that were clearly marked as Border Patrol trucks. Both the agents were in full uniform. They had patches on their arms and their chest. They had a full duty belt on with cargo pants. This area where these two individuals...
Does the evidence show that the Border Patrol agents actually saw the defendants cross the border?
The evidence does, Your Honor.
Or were they seen by the agents only after they had crossed the border and drew attention to themselves?
With regards to when the agents saw the individuals, Your Honor, first with regards to Ms. Perez, that the testimony at trial was that the agent said he saw her as she was crossing the border. The judge, as we noted in our briefing, committed error in stating that there had been a brief moment when the Border Patrol agent did not see her, but there is nothing in the record to support that finding of the judge. With regards to Ms. Alvarado, the agent said that he first observed her because she was running toward him. His attention was drawn to her because she was running toward him. He did not say that he saw her as she crossed the border, but there is case law in Lopez versus Sessions that says if the precise place where an alien crossed, if the agent is able to point out the precise place where the alien crossed, then that is evidence that the alien was not free. That agent said that she crossed at the edge of the border fence. So he was able to
For the principle you're advancing, would it matter if the alien, you know, made a run for it, was under continuous surveillance, saw the agent, and then, you know, tried to make an escape? Does that change your analysis?
Your Honor, there are facts in regards to whether or not the alien tries to leave that would change the analysis. If the alien perhaps had run back to Mexico, that would change the analysis. Or if the alien was in an area where they could get away and out of the sight of the agent, where they weren't, I'll go back to Judge Vasquez and Franco Lopez. She said that official restraint is when the alien is in the clutches of the authority the whole time, and they have no authority to get free from them. And Your Honor, I see that I have a minute and 40 seconds left.
Before you sit down, okay. Going back to your position on the difference between physical surveillance and electronic surveillance, does it matter for your argument if the alien is aware he's being electronically surveilled?
I think that if the alien, it does make a difference. If the alien is just electronically surveilled and they're, for instance, see cameras, they know that they are being seen by cameras, but there isn't anyone around that is close enough to apprehend them, then they're not in the clutches of the authorities at that time. They have the authority to try to get free. Stated another way is that the observation was so constant and close that the alien had no hope of escaping into the general population, and they were as good as caught. May I reserve the remaining time?
You may. I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Let's hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. McGillivray, Good afternoon to the court. May it please the court. Gaspar Miguel recognized the longstanding treatment of entry as a term of art as it existed in the civil realm primarily and even somewhat in the criminal realm. But in looking at the statute, the court decided that entry doesn't apply in the context of Section 1325A1 as it does in the civil realm. And very specifically, it held that constant surveillance does not constitute official restraint. Gaspar Miguel cannot be distinguished from the facts of this case because the agents in this case did nothing more than merely survey the aliens as they crossed into the United States. Official restraint without surveillance is typically something that arises in the context of ports of entry, where somebody lands and is, you know, being presented to customs and whatnot, that they're typically found to have been under official restraint there. If you're talking about official restraint without surveillance, that's never going to apply in the context of 1325A1 because 1325A1 is concerned with entries that occur that places are not ports of entry. And it's not clear even under the Ninth Circuit's case law that Ms. Alvarado would not have affected an entry. And the distinction between those two cases, between Ms. Pettis and Ms. Alvarado, you know, shows the wisdom of the Gaspar Miguel court's decision not to adopt the surveillance as restraint notion. Ms. Alvarado Diaz and the magistrate judge credited the testimony of the agent. She was not seen by the agent as she crossed into the United States. And under Ninth Circuit case law, if you're not observed the moment you cross, then you are not under official restraint. So in these two different cases, Ms. Pettis in the Ninth Circuit would not have affected an entry, but Ms. Alvarado Diaz would have. And this court in Gaspar Miguel specifically looked at the policy and practical considerations and the criminal realm to look at that type of conduct and say there's no reasoned basis for treating these two people differently. And it's for the same reasons and in the same way that the court should also reject the appellant's attempt to graft another element of civil entry onto Section 1325A1. In enacting Section 1325, Congress did not intend to permit aliens to create their own ports of entry. But that is precisely what the appellant's interpretation of the statute would do. No court, not even the Ninth Circuit, which has adopted the different element of civil entry, has required the government to prove that an alien intended to evade inspection in order to have violated Section 1325A1. And looking at the text, structure and purpose of the statute all counsel against rewriting it to add that element. Now, starting with the text as we must, 1325A1 is very straightforward. It simply says that aliens are prohibited from entering the United States at any time or place, quote, other than as designated by immigration officers, end quote. It is the immigration officers, not the aliens, who get to decide where entries can be made. And on the defense's telling, the defense's interpretation would flip that on its head. In their reply brief, they specifically note that if an alien crosses into the United States and immediately turns themselves into law enforcement, they have not affected an entry and have not violated 1325A1, quote, even when the border crossing occurred at a location other than an inspection point, close quote. That is directly and inextricably at odds with the plain language of 1325A1, which says precisely the opposite, that it's unlawful for an alien to enter at any time or place other than as designated by immigration officials. And that makes good sense because it's immigration officials who are charged with ensuring compliance with immigration laws. So it makes sense that in seeking to facilitate the enforcement of those laws, you would try to funnel any foreign national attempting to come to the United States to a port of entry. Looking at the structure of 1325A, specifically A1 through 3, supports the government's interpretation. A1 simply says you must enter at the port. A2 says you cannot elude examination or inspection by an immigration officer once you're at the port. And A3 says you can't make any material misrepresentations or omissions to immigration officers. It's exceedingly simple in its design, and under the government's interpretation, it's exactly how you would draft up a statute if you were seeking to incentivize or disincentivize illegal crossings.
But we do have, as Gaspar recognized and other circuits have recognized, there is a long settled, you know, common law definition of entry that kind of muddies the waters here. You know, as the district court here wrote, muddies the water for the evolution of the statute from the 1920s scheme to the current scheme. And I understand your position that we don't need to get there because there's no physical restraint here. But if we did take that step, how would the government, would your position be that the text trumps the earlier common law or court-made definitions? Would that be your bottom line on entry, the meaning of entry?
Yes, Your Honor. And any time that the government doesn't deny that there's this longstanding interpretation of entry as a term of art. It can't deny it. It's been around for a long time. But that's not really the question. That raises the question. The question is, does it apply in the context of criminal immigration statutes and specifically in the context of Section 1325? And what the Supreme Court has said and what other courts have done, I believe this court did so in Thomas, was when deciding whether something is a term of art or to be given its plain meaning, you engage in a plain language analysis. You look at the text, the structure, the purpose of the statute, the historical context, and you do all of those things to determine whether it fits. And in trying to fit the elements of civil entry into 1325A1, they clash. They effectively clash. I mean, we made the example in the brief, and I'll point it out here that, you know, if it was the intent for Congress to include an element of evasion of inspection, it wrote something very similar in A2. And yet A1 and A2 are distinct offenses, whereas the official restraint, or I'm sorry, the civil definition of entry would add that element to A1, even though Congress didn't include it there. So these two, the doctrine as it exists and has existed, just can't be squared with the text. And it's contrary to the purpose. I'd make the point again, the language plainly states that you can enter at any time or place other than as designated by immigration officers. And under civil entry, you can do that and not have affected an entry, so long as you didn't intend to evade inspection. But that would allow aliens to enter wherever they choose. You know, the case that is relied heavily on by appellants is instructive. In Pierre V. Ripken, you had a group of Haitian nationals who arrived, landed 10 miles north of the port in Key West, Florida. They arrived in the early morning hours and they were unapprehended. They walked away from the boat and they hid in a heavily wooded area where they were for several hours until sheriffs, local law enforcement arrived and called them out to come out. In that case, the Southern District of Florida determined that they had not affected an entry. Because they didn't flee when law enforcement called them, so they didn't intend to evade inspection. That is the type of conduct that would be permissible if you adopted the civil entry element of intent to evade inspection. And it would be completely contrary to A1's mandate that doesn't matter, what matters is whether you entered at a time or place designated by immigration officers. It would also be contrary to this circuit's precedent concerning the requisite mental state that must be established to show a violation of Section 1326. It's usually in the context of 1326 that this issue has been raised. And this court has repeatedly stated that the only intent that's necessary is the intent to do the prohibited act, which is to enter. The government does not need, for example, to prove that an alien has a specific intent to enter after deportation in the context of 1326. And in the Hernandez-Baida case, this court specifically said that 1326 requires no specific motive to be established. So we would go from having a regulatory offense, which typically does not carry a high level mens rea offense, to having a requirement that an alien must specifically intend to evade inspection. And the practical import of that would be that aliens get to enter wherever they choose, so long as at some point down the line, as they may claim in, like they did in Pierre V. Ripken, that they didn't intend to evade inspection. That also would be contrary to the broader purposes of the statute and other illegal entry provisions that specifically mandate and impose obligations on other people to avoid aliens coming into the United States at places that are not ports. In, you know, Section 1321, for example, imposes a duty on any person to prevent the landing of aliens at a place that isn't a port of entry. Section 1324 makes it unlawful for any person to bring an alien to the U.S. at a place other than a designated port of entry. The import of all these provisions, end of 1325A1 through 3, is very clear. Go to ports of entry so that the people charged with facilitating and ensuring compliance with immigration laws can conduct an inspection, and that they can do so at the places where resources have been designated for them to conduct these types of inspections, not, you know, not anywhere along the 7,000-mile land border that we have. It's a wholly uncontroversial proposition to expect a request that foreign nationals coming into this country do so at ports of entry. And it would be odd to expect people not to. So for all of those reasons, the court should, as it did in Gaspar Miguel, recognize that the statute does not necessarily warrant treatment of entry as a term of art. And it should hold, as it did there, that these two things are discrete and distinct, and not rewrite the statute and add an element of intent to evade inspection, which no other court has done.
What do we do with the fact that when Congress amended the statute, it retained the term entry, yet it didn't provide a specific definition? And can't we? We can acknowledge that Congress knew the previous definitions and permitted those to be imported into the revised statute.
Well, Judge Timkovich, that's sort of an odd way to look at it, to say that, okay, Congress, presumed to legislate with an awareness of terms of art, is aware that entry has a specialized meaning, and that since 1952, when the definition was added, even though it didn't include the language regarding official restraint or anything else, courts had continued to put that graph on it. So Congress, if they're presumed to be aware of that graph, what does it mean when they take that definition and completely excise it from the statute? That I point the court to Judge Bybee's dissent in the Argueta Rosales case in the Ninth Circuit, where it said that should have been an indication that maybe it's time to turn away from things, turn away from, you know, the adoption of the official restraint element in the criminal realm. I'd also point out that, the court has to look at the text of the statute and see how well these two things can mesh, if at all. And it's the government's position that they can't. Now, if the court doesn't have any further questions, I'm happy to yield my time there.
All right. We have some rebuttal time left. Ms. McGillwright.
Your Honor, the facts in this case present the most minimal, simplest form of official restraint. The facts here would prevent this court, if they found on these facts, from facing a situation where then there would be parsing out of what official restraint is, leading to arbitrary and meaningless distinctions. And despite the government's contention otherwise, this isn't a Ninth Circuit. This definition is not just in the Ninth Circuit in the criminal context. I see I went over. May I finish my statement?
Yeah, ma'am. Please proceed. I was going to give you a minute, so.
Oh, thank you. So in the First Circuit, this was adopted in the criminal case of U.S. versus Cavazzangian. In the Second Circuit, it was adopted in U.S. versus Macias. In the Third Circuit, freedom from official restraint in context with the definition of entry was adopted in the case of U.S. versus Vasilatos. In the Fourth Circuit, it was adopted in Lazarescu versus United States. In the Fifth Circuit, it was adopted in three cases. Then there was an unpublished case that says the court has held that illegal reentry or unlawful presence requires both physical presence in the country and freedom from official restraint, indicating the Fifth Circuit had held that. But the Fifth Circuit subsequently said that we have mentioned it, but we have not explicitly adopted the doctrine. But then you go down to the Sixth Circuit in Lopez versus Session, the court it was noted that this should apply both criminally and civilly. And then you get to the Ninth Circuit, which I understand.
Excuse me, you've cited all those cases in your briefing, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Most of these weren't they? I think several of them were in the 28J letter that you.
There was.
It's a 1952 Fourth Circuit case and a 2011 Fifth Circuit case, which.
Yes, Lazarescu.
And all right, so, counsel, I think your time's expired.
Thank you.
I appreciate the arguments this morning. You're excused, and the case shall be submitted.